Blog Talk Radio.
Mama Africa, Mama Africa, I'm coming home, hello Mama Africa, how are you? I'm feeling fine, and I hope you're fine too. Hello Mama Africa, how are you? I hope when you hear these words, your grace turn blue, grace turn blue. I'm saying these words to let you know how much I care and I won't let go. Even though we're oceans away, you're
welcome to another episode of Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon. And this week, we've got another special program. It's kind of a unique program. We're going to be featuring the first couple parts of a radio documentary that was created and produced by two folks, Asit Ismi and Kristen Swartz. And we're going to be examining the first part. I'll explain the documentary to you in a few moments. But I want to introduce the show to our returning listeners, as well as new listeners. And I want to say this to our new listeners as well as a part of what I say to all listeners each week. It's vastly important that you spread the word about this show, not for my own self-aggrandizement. This show is not about me, the host. It's about getting information out there that is consistently omitted and marginalized by the corporate-backed, corporate-financed mainstream media. The corporate media that does everything it can to place things in a very, very narrowly slanted perspective. They do everything they can to omit certain information and to slant things so that the general populace, which is us, remain in the dark about very complex issues that are going on all throughout the world.
By extending for another year U.S. sanctions against Zimbabwe, Barack Obama has removed all doubt that his Africa policy is essentially the same as George Bush's: regime change and the deliberate creation of so-called failed states. It is the same story in Somalia, Sudan, and the Congo, where Obama's Democrats pursue identical objectives to Bush Republicans: to undermine and overthrow any African government that does not bow to Washington's will, and to encourage the effective dismantling of inconvenient African nation-states. This is imperialism in the raw. George Bush's economic war against Zimbabwe is now Barack Obama's war, predicated on the same imperial logic. Like Bush's sanctions, imposed in 2003 and then expanded in 2005 and 2008, Obama's sanctions are directed against President Robert Mugabe and individuals and companies associated with his political party. The White House justifies this economic aggression by claiming that Mugabe and his associates pose an unusual and extraordinary threat to American foreign policy. Not even a threat to American interests, mind you, but to U.S. foreign policy. This is a blatant, naked attempt at regime change. Obama is saying in no uncertain terms that the U.S. has the right to seek the ouster of any government whose policies diverge from those of Washington. Imperialism by definition. Obama has placed the United States in opposition to the will of the African Union and Zimbabwe's southern African neighbors, who support the current power-sharing agreement between Mugabe and the opposition party. In thwarting the will of the African Union and Zimbabwe's neighbors, President Obama sabotages the quest for self-determination for the African continent as a whole. He carries on George Bush's legacy as the main destabilizer of Africa. Also against the wishes of the African Union, the U.S., Britain, and France are the main movers behind the indictment of Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir by the International Criminal Court on charges of committing crimes against humanity in Darfur. The U.S. position is morally bankrupt, since the United States refuses to place itself under the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court, fearing retribution against the far larger crimes against humanity committed by the U.S. in multiple countries around the planet, crimes for which Barack Obama is now directly responsible. Nothing could be clearer than that the U.S. would like to break up Sudan, Africa's largest country, into smaller pieces, the better to control and exploit its natural resources. The dismemberment of Somalia in the Horn of Africa was further consolidated by the U.S.-backed invasion by Ethiopia. In Central Africa, the United States continues to foment chaos through the militaries of its client states, Uganda and Rwanda, with genocidal results in the Congo. There is only one demand that people of goodwill should make of Barack Obama's White House: U.S. out of Africa, now. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
This is Solomon. I'm back. Sorry we had a little bit of technical difficulty where my line got cut. And that's kind of curious. As soon as I start talking about the mainstream media, it conveniently gets cut. But I don't want to get into that conspiracy. But I was able to redirect you guys to Brother Glenn Ford of Black Agenda Report, which is a good segue into what we're going to talk about, or not talk about, what the show is going to be about today, which is going to be, it's going to have to do with the U.S. involvement through its various appendages, such as the CIA, the Pentagon, USAID, and how they've the World Bank, IMF, we know the U.S. by and large part controls those two organs and how they've played a significant role in destabilizing Africa through military engagement, through engaging corrupt African governments such as in Rwanda and Uganda by arming them to the gill militarily. And so we're going to get into that. But as I was saying before I magically got cut off the air, you know, this show is not about me. It's about us. It's about us getting information out by any means necessary. I created this show out of frustration based on what I've always seen, or in this case, not seen on the mainstream media, and that's issues in their proper context, issues relating to, you know, so-called third world nations, you know, developing countries, issues that have to do with, you know, third world nations within this empire known as the United States of America, you know, whether it's Detroit or Baltimore or D.C. or Watts or Compton, you know, we rarely see our issues, see issues of people coming from disadvantaged or what I like to refer to as governmentally neglected communities addressed in their proper light and addressed, you know, from the perspective of the root causes of things. And that's, and oftentimes we see, you know, the living conditions that people of color live in within the United States of America. You know, these things that didn't just happen overnight. They're things that happened over a long term, going all the way back to the inception, the stealing of Africans and enslaving those Africans and bringing them to the U.S. and going to antebellum South and going through 200 years, or you know, going to Jim, you know, over 140 some odd years of Jim Crow and over 200 years of shadow slavery. You know, these things that we call ghettos or slums, you know, I like to call them governmentally neglected communities because it puts more pressure on the government in terms of calling it what it is, you know, and who established these things. And they're functioning just like some folks want them to function. They're functioning just like they intended. And we don't hear these issues brought up in their proper perspective. We don't see the systemic roots of these issues addressed in any kind of contextual, analytical, hard-hitting manner. They don't ever, you know, touch on white supremacy as an issue in America. They don't touch on systemic racism as still being a driving force that fuels a lot of these issues. And so this radio show was created out of frustration, out of need, and there's so many other independent media outlets that are out there that are doing such fine work, such as Black Agenda Report, and there's so many other local radio stations on various FM dials that are doing a good job in terms of getting, you know, critical information out. And we have to continue to do that. We have to continue to push the envelope, you know, towards that precipice so that many, many, many more people are in the know. You know, it serves us no good to just be the only ones that know about this stuff. We need to get more and more. We need to widen the base so that more and more people know about these issues, because the access to information, to critical information, oftentimes creates activism on a number of levels, you know, knowing is half the battle. You know, understanding is the other. And so that's what we try to do here with Your World News, put things in a proper context and so that the listener can really more comprehensively understand the different complex intersectionalities that that exist within these social issues, not just domestically but globally. And so anyways, without further ado, I want to play the first half of, or the first part of a four-part documentary done by Asad Ismi and was produced by Kristen Schwartz. And, you know, they're out of Canada. And within the next week or so, we should, you know, I should have all four episodes on Your World News. Tomorrow evening, I just want to let you guys know, tomorrow evening I'll be interviewing a strong brother who is a student. He's the student coordinator of the Friends of the Congo, and that's Kambali Musavuli. And he's going to be talking about a number of things relating to the Congo, relating to as well as things that are very solutions-oriented in terms of what folks are doing within the Congo, what folks are doing outside of Congo. You know, this is one of the legit and progressive solutions-oriented nonprofit organizations that's doing some serious work within the continent and specifically within Congo, unlike some more disingenuous nonprofit organizations, which we'll get into tomorrow, which we have already gotten into in previous shows. So without further ado, this is the first part of Militarizing Africa. We won't be taking any calls for the next 29 minutes. So listen, download it. If you're listening on to archive, even if you're listening live, you know, download it. Spread the word to your friends. Pass it along. Knowledge is power. What these folks are talking about, what all my guests are talking about, is some serious issues that you will not find on the corporate-backed mainstream media, and I'd like to say the criminal-minded mainstream media. So this is Militarizing Africa.
The ravaging of Africa has been enriching Europe and North America for more than 500 years.
First, European empires imposed slavery and colonialism on the continent.
After 1945, the United States took over as the dominant neo-colonial power.
Through the Pentagon and the CIA, the U.S. government has fueled 14 wars in Africa.
It is American invasion, but the U.S. role is everything.
The U.S. has used the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to systematically demolish African economies and health and education sectors.
Par les stratégies de la Banque mondiale, les pauvres seront toujours pauvres, les riches seront toujours riches.
This military and economic war enables the looting of Africa's resources by Western multinational corporations.
Shell is into the politics of Nigeria, you know. We might say we have our independence, but economically, we are still being colonized.
Washington's genocidal imperial strategy has killed more than 26 million Africans, but failed to suppress popular resistance.
We have refused to die. We are living for Africa. No matter what they do, no matter what power they have.
You are listening to The Ravaging of Africa, a four-part documentary series about the destructive impact of U.S. imperialism on the continent. I'm Asad Ismi.
I'm Kristen Schwartz.
Voices and sounds in this series were recorded at the 2007 World Social Forum, held in Nairobi, Kenya.
This is Militarizing Africa, the opening episode in our series. For the next half hour, we focus on the wars in the Democratic Republic of the Congo and Somalia. Stay tuned. Nearly 80% of the strategic minerals the United States requires are found in Africa, including 90% of the world's cobalt, 90% of the platinum, 40% of the gold, 98% of the chromium, 64% of the manganese, and one-third of the uranium. These minerals are needed to make jet engines, cars, missiles, electronic components, iron, and steel. No industrial society can exist without these substances. Africa also accounts for 18% of U.S. oil imports, a number which is expected to rise.
Africa is the most war-torn region in the world, with armed conflicts going on in 9 countries: Democratic Republic of the Congo, Sudan, Ethiopia with Somalia, civil war in Ethiopia, Uganda, Chad, Nigeria, Morocco with Western Sahara, and Algeria. The U.S. has provided arms and military training to participants in all of these 9 wars. Washington has done the same in another 5 wars that ended during 2002 to 2006. These are the long civil wars in Angola, Sierra Leone, Burundi, and Liberia, as well as that in Congo-Brazzaville.
According to William Hartung, co-author of the report Deadly Legacy, U.S. Arms to Africa and the Congo War, the U.S. sent $1.5 billion in arms and training to Africa during the Cold War years, 1950 to 1989. This, quote, set the stage for the current round of conflicts in the region, unquote, He further points out that, quote, the military skills and equipment supplied by the United States are still being used by combatants in these wars, unquote.
Following the end of the Cold War, the Clinton administration undertook a wave of new military training programs in Africa. In the 1990s, the U.S. gave military assistance to 50 countries in Africa out of a total of 53. The U.S. has four different military training programs for Africa.
Since 2001, the Bush administration has doubled U.S. military aid to Africa and quadrupled U.S. arms transfers. In February 2007, Bush set up a new Pentagon command for Africa called AFRICOM. It is headquartered at the huge U.S. military base at Djibouti in the Horn of Africa, close to Saudi Arabia and Yemen. The base houses 2,000 U.S. troops, mainly special forces, as well as CIA operatives. Given its strategic location, AFRICOM's purpose appears to be control of African and Middle Eastern oil.
The most destructive case of U.S. military intervention in Africa is the war in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the heart of the continent. The war has killed more than 4 million people since 1998 and destroyed the second largest country in Africa. The Congo is the richest country in the continent, holding the world's biggest copper, cobalt, and cadmium deposits. The U.S.'s proxies for this genocide are Rwanda and Uganda, which started the war in 1998 by invading the Congo with Washington's encouragement and support, and have since been looting the country's resources and sending them to the West. Oxfam called this war the world's biggest humanitarian disaster.
Angola, Zimbabwe, and Namibia sent their armies to support the Congo government, and Burundi joined the other side. Thus began Africa's first world war, involving seven armies, which has further wrecked a country crushed by more than a century of Western domination. The U.S. has given arms and military training to all seven armies.
Rwanda and Uganda are the U.S.'s staunchest allies in the region, and Washington backed the invasion of the Congo, according to Human Rights Watch. Uganda received $1.5 million in U.S. arms and military training in 1999. U.S. Special Forces have trained the Rwandan army in counterinsurgency, combat, and psychological operations. This included instructions about fighting in the Congo. To keep the war going, the U.S. has helped the other side too, with Zimbabwe getting $1.4 million in U.S. military training in 2000 and Namibia $500,000.
Mfuni Kazadi is from the Congo and is Secretary General of the group Coalition for the Cancellation of the Illegitimate Deaths of the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
And when the war started, they were ships of American at Mwanda. I tell you, it is confirmed by the Angolese. And that ship, its mission was to gather all the communication for Uganda's and Rwanda's army, which were in Mwanda and Kitona. You see? So it is confirmed. And also, when the war were going on, the Americans were part of the problem, because their authorities said that the Congo is too big, must be divided into four states. If the Congolese, if they can't find any solution to the war, so the Congo must be divided. So the resistance of people, that's why the resistance of people have caused 4 million people dead. So
you see that the Rwandans were used like a puppet. They put them in space to fight for the interests of the United States.
Under a peace deal signed in 2002, Rwanda and Uganda formally withdrew their forces from the Congo. But fighting continues in the eastern part of the country, with Rwanda and Uganda using proxy forces to control territory and continue the looting. The United Nations has identified 85 foreign multinational corporations based in the US, Europe, and South Africa that have been looting the resources of the Congo as the war has raged. Those include the big diamond company, De Beers, the mining giant, Anglo American, Barclays Bank, Bayer AG, Cabot Corporation, and the Canadian mining companies, Barrick Gold and Banro.
In an example of organized crime, many companies have funded military operations, thus perpetuating the war. The Congo War is a horrifying example of all three instruments used by the U.S. in its attempt to dominate Africa: military invasion, World Bank IMF economic control, and Western corporate plunder.
All the looting material have been transferred, have been exported to the United States for nothing, you see. So the Congolese have lost everything.
And there was only The Hague last year who condemned Uganda to pay $10 billion. But they said we have no power to oblige Uganda to pay that amount. So that we say, if they have condemned Uganda, Rwanda should be also condemned because they were a party of the invasion. Why Rwanda should get away from that tribunal?
The Congo War has displaced more than 3 million people, forcing many of them to flee to other countries. Women have been particularly affected by the war. Rape has been used so widely as a weapon in the war that doctors cannot believe its extent. It's estimated that 250,000 women have been raped by combatants, the victims ranging from a 2-year-old to a 70-year-old. About 1/3 of rape victims have contracted HIV and AIDS. Millicent Okumu is secretary of the Federation of Congolese Abroad, an international organization with branches in the Congo and 11 other countries that provides resettlement services to expatriate Congolese. The Federation also contributes to reconstruction efforts inside the Congo, including raising funds for hospital supplies.
The burden on the war falls on the woman, because the woman is in charge of the children, is in charge of everything in the house, in the home. So when a woman cannot run away and leave the kids, you have to struggle that you protect your children. The women are the most suffering people. Many women and girls are victims of rape. So it is not something which is a secret. It's well known that women were so much raped, so much traumatized, so much that some of them are affected till now. If it was a girl, he can't allow himself to get involved with a man because of the trauma that she went through. When a woman is raped, maybe you don't know the man had HIV, you don't know the man has STDs. So if you are raped and you're being infected, now that life has been destroyed. Maybe you're having you got pregnant through that rape. That child will be traumatizing you, because this is a child that I got out of my will, out of my wish. Now when you destroy a woman, you're destroying the community, you're destroying the family.
Since 2002, at Washington's insistence, the Congo has been subjected to a World Bank IMF structural adjustment program, which means that its economic policy is being set by these two U.S.-dominated institutions. A major effect of this policy is to legalize the corporate looting of the Congo. Under World Bank rules, foreign companies pay almost nothing to the government for lucrative mining concessions.
What the U.S. has done, they also say that you must work with IMF and World Bank. And when the World Bank came, they put in place reform, macroeconomic reform. They have made new code of investment. In that code of investment, they are saying that if the investor comes, he's the right to repatriate the benefits.
All the benefits.
So now we have lost a lot of mining, rich mining concessions, for nothing. You understand? So who gain? You find that all the company in the front in there are United States. You understand? So this is a very, very systematic policy taken by the United States. Now they have also made what we call code minier, mineral code. In mineral code, they said the investor can take up to 90% of share, up 90% of share, and leave only 10% of share to the government.
It's not investment, we call it pseudo investment.
It's plunder.
It's blunder, robbery. With what are we going to build the Congo as far as the multinational has taken everything?
The objective of the U.S. is to gain control of the economic riches of the Congo. To do this, Washington first used war and genocide, and then the World Bank and the IMF, combined with the threat of a return to a wider war.
The World Bank said, this is the price of the peace. You should give up. You see, you should give up your company. You should give up your concession. This is the price you have to pay for the peace. We are like, we are used like slaves. We are just producing. Well, they give you a small amount of money, but all the benefits are taken by transforming the material outside. You understand? I like to see a Congo where people are in the work working. They produce. And not only producing the primary raw material, but also transform the material in place so that they can sell and get more benefit. Because now, all what we are doing, we are just selling the gross product we gain, so there is no any benefit which came from that. All these raw materials are being transformed outside, you understand?
Patrice Lumumba was the first elected leader of the Congo. He served in office for only 2 months. Because of his desire for economic independence, the U.S. had him assassinated in 1961. Washington replaced him with his puppet, Colonel Mobutu, a brutal military dictator who murdered thousands of Congolese and looted the country for 37 years in league with Western multinational corporations. Mobutu's reign continued the plunder and killing begun by Belgium, which colonized the Congo from 1885 to 1960. Lumumba is one of Africa's greatest heroes.
He was killed because of that. He was asking to give the independence, the economic independence. You see, that is the same policy now. If you raise your voice, you will be killed. That was the example to show to the Congolese that if you try to resist us, we are going to do the same as we did with Lumumba.
After 37 years of U.S.-imposed dictatorship and 8 years of a U.S.-backed genocidal war, the Congo is close to becoming the poorest country in the world, with 95% of its population unemployed and subject to chronic malnutrition. Yet it is worth noting that in spite of the catastrophe it has wrought in the Congo, the U.S. has not been able to achieve a major objective, that of balkanizing the country. Washington's military strategy has failed in the Congo because of the fierce resistance of the Congolese people. Desire for mineral riches has led the U.S. to invade not just the Congo, but also Somalia in December 2006, this time using the Ethiopian army as proxy. Somalia possesses substantial deposits of petroleum and is strategically located close to Saudi Arabia. The invasion was coordinated and supported from the U.S. military base at Djibouti, which borders Somalia. U.S. Special Forces and CIA operatives at the base helped to design the invasion. U.S. planes and ships bombed Somalia during the invasion, and special forces accompanied the Ethiopian military into Somalia. The Ethiopian army has been trained and armed by the United States, which is the main backer of Meles Zenawi, the country's murderous dictator. Washington plans to ensure that two-thirds of Somalia's oil fields are taken over by the American oil companies Conoco, Amoco, Chevron, and Phillips. The puppet Prime Minister of Somalia has proposed a new oil law to encourage the return of foreign oil companies to the country.
Ethiopian troops occupy Mogadishu, Somalia's capital, where fierce fighting continues between them and Somali resistance groups. The Ethiopian military has committed horrendous war crimes, killing thousands of civilians by shelling densely populated neighborhoods indiscriminately. As a result, 365,000 Somalis have fled the capital.
Farah Malam is chairman of Ford People, the third largest political party in the Kenyan parliament. He's a former member of parliament from Lagdera, which borders Somalia and is part of Kenya's northeastern province. Malam is both Kenyan and Somali, and an expert on U.S. policy towards Somalia and the Horn of Africa.
It's American invasion. Well, the U.S. role is everything. The Ethiopians were sent in by the Americans, we believe that, and they were too happy and too glad to do the dirty job for the Americans, to do the errands for the Americans. You could safely say that this is a genocide against the Somali people. So it's the American helicopters, helicopter gunships that literally pulverized them from, you know, so many kilometers away where they could not reach them. And that's basically what turned the tables of the war. And the Ethiopian soldiers are there just to, you know, when the Americans do the damage from the sky, to, you know, finish off the rest. Basically, that's it. And to maintain the ground troops presence. From the sea, they're using missiles, you know, and American Marines who also, they land their boots also on the ground as often as they want.
To justify its invasion of Somalia, the U.S. claimed that it was looking for three terrorists. Halima Abdi Arush is Somali and chairperson of EDA, Women's Development Organization, a non-governmental organization based in Mogadishu.
While you're searching for three people, killing and bombing millions of people is not fair. This is what happened in the south of Somalia. The first day there was a big celebration of a wedding which was bombed. Many people from both families died. There were nomads who were moving from one area to another who also died. If these things happen, the people that they are searching for today, maybe they do not find them, but they can find them tomorrow, because the survivors of that wedding, the brothers and sisters of the nomads that were killed, will become radical. They are starting to get angry against the Western countries, against the Americans, and they can be the base for terrorist groups.
As with the Congo, the U.S. wants to divide Somalia into several smaller countries to make the oil easier to control.
There's this massive and enormous oil deposits that Somalia sits on, and that's what America wants. So what actually the American scheme on this is to balkanize Somalia, break it up into like five small mini-states, just like the Gulf states, the Emirates, yeah, and each one of them to have a small clan or tribal ruler, as such that America now becomes the dominant power that can have a separate deal with each one of them, and have Ethiopia's military power on the other side to intimidate them all along, as such that they do not have any independence. Every clan can have a small oil field, which basically will be run by the Americans.
While it has tried unsuccessfully to destroy the Congo as a state, the U.S. has actually accomplished the same in the case of Somalia. Washington was the main force behind the disintegration of Somalia in 1990. During the 1980s, Somalia was the top recipient per capita of U.S. military and economic aid in Africa. Siad Barre, the country's dictator at the time, was a key strategic ally of Washington in the Cold War and got $600 million in U.S. aid. Following Barre's rampage of killing and plunder, Somalia literally fell apart. Barre's forces murdered 5,000 unarmed civilians in 88, 89, and in 1990, he was overthrown.
With no central government, Somalia descended into chaos and civil war. The U.S. backed one warlord after another for the next 16 years to foment war and division and prevent the emergence of a central authority. This fighting has killed 1 million Somalis out of a population of 8 million. U.S. forces invaded Somalia in 1992 but were defeated and humiliated by Somali resistance fighters. When during 2006, the Islamic Courts Union appeared close to forming a central government and ending the civil war, the U.S. unleashed the Ethiopian invasion.
Roolka kaliya ay ciyaareen waxay noqotay in ay nimanka warlordka ahaay oo wadamada wadanka dhibaatada ku hayay kaliya inay kaalmeeyaan. Mar walbaba shacabka waa dareemayay inay jirto arintaas oo Mareykanka arrimaha ku jiro, waayihii hore waa inkiri jireen, markii dambena si toos ah u cadaysteen.
The only role of the Americans was to support these warlords who have brought all this chaos to the country. Americans used to deny this, but the Somali people were aware of their involvement, and in the end, the Americans made it clear themselves that they were doing this.
Markaas waxaa dhacay dagaalo oo aan cidna loogu aabayeelin oo xaafadaha xamar ka dhacay oo kumanaan qofood ay ku dhinteen waqtiyeyas. Kadibna ay dhacday arintaas inay fursad u siiso qof la arko qofkii wax fahmay iyo ma aragtay dadkii lacagta qabay inay kaalmeeyaan dadka hor yimaada dadkaas, waxaana abuurmay gurubkii loo yaqiinay ICU Islamic Courtiska oo si degdeg ah u guulaystay.
There were chaos in Mogadishu. Thousands of people were killed. That's why the Islamic Courts Union was created, to stop the chaos.
Halima's husband and brother were killed in the civil war. Almost every Somali family has suffered similar losses.
So you could safely say that for the last 16 years, Somalia was maintained in the state it was in terms of disintegration of society and state and not having a center or a central government for that matter. Through the Ethiopian direct interference, as well as the Americans had a direct interest in Somalia, but using a proxy, Ethiopia, directly and militarily. I think they don't want a viable central power in Somalia. Not just strong, they don't want any viable central power in Somalia. The U.S. interest is, I'll tell you, the U.S. interest in blocking that is that Somalia is known to sit on massive deposits of minerals, oil and other minerals too, including uranium. The Americans have tried for a very long time through their own companies to get concessions, but based on their own dictates. From the former Somali dictator Siad Barre. You could say anything you want about Siad Barre, but he was a nationalist. So he never allowed an unfair deal between him and the Americans. He would say, if it takes 100 years later, well, let the sons and the daughters of the soil come out with the right technology and the right knowledge for them to exploit their own natural resources instead of you taking it cheaply from me now. Because there was a 70-30 kind of an arrangement that the Americans wanted, I think, through Conoco, which is an American oil company, and others. That's what I hear. But then he refused. He said, sorry, it has to be a fair deal. More benefits going to the Somalis and less to the Americans. Well, the Americans supported Siad Barre, but later on again undermined him. So there is a very reliable information that most of the warlords who took up arms against Siad Barre also had the tacit support of the American center. Supporting the warlords and basically going for this disintegration of the state and society. The sad part of it is that it's militarizing a society that essentially is not a militaristic society. It has better priorities in life. It has different priorities. It has economic welfare, education, development as such, and other things.
You have been listening to Militarizing Africa, the first episode of the documentary series The Ravaging of Africa.
The Ravaging of Africa is dedicated to the memory of Patrice Lumumba.
This series was written by Asad Ismi and produced by Kristen Schwartz. Go to www.asadismi.ws. That's www.asadismi.ws for more information or to download the series.
Translation by Maziar Mahajir at Toronto Conversation Corner and Farid Omar. Voiceover by Benedicta Madawo.
Theme music is Nerbalankina by Captain Yaba from Ghana.
On this episode, you also heard Mukaji by Papa Wemba from the Congo. This series was funded by Canadian Union of Public Employees Local 3903, QP National, Canadian Union of Postal Workers National, CUPW North Bay Local, Canadian Labour Congress, Public Service Alliance of Canada, Ontario Secondary School Teachers Federation, Ontario English Catholic Teachers Association, Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, and Mining Watch Canada.
Thank you for listening.
Yes, I'm back. Hope you guys enjoyed the first part of that four-part documentary. As I said before, I'll be airing all four of those in their entirety, you know, within the next couple of weeks. Tomorrow we have a very special interview with Brother Kambali of Friends of the Congo, and we're really going to get into the unique, very productive, strong work that that they're doing to bring assistance and relief to people of Congo who have had an immense loss of life and devastation brought upon them for a number of reasons, and that's why I played the first part of this documentary. We're going to play all four. We're going to have Brother Kambali on tomorrow, but these are, reoccurring things that we've been talking about. Brother Keith Harmon Snow, touched on this a couple of weeks ago when we had him on the show for the very first time, and then even last week when we had him on the show, he touched on it a little bit more. But it's, a complex issue like this. I don't think that you can have too much information, especially when you've been, most of us have been left in the dark for a long, long time, and we got wind about what was going on. It was our responsibility to go out and acquire that information, knowing what we know about the mainstream media, that they weren't going to give it to us. So we had to go out there and get it for ourselves. And now that we have access to all these different things and these individuals, through interviews and through radio documentaries and through articles and treatises that we find on the web, it's our responsibility to understand as best we can and get the information out to so many other folks, and to actually, join coalitions with organizations like Friends of the Congo and help, investigative reporters like Keith Harmon Snow, so that they can continue to really put the pressure on those folks that are responsible for sustaining this and creating this issue, and to also provide assistance and relief and stabilization for those folks affected, not just in Congo, but in various other countries throughout the continent of Africa. And the continent of Africa is without a doubt being attacked by imperialist forces that you can pretty much call them. Depending on what your definition of a terrorist is, I would call the imperialist forces that are attacking Congo through IMF, through militarization. Yeah, I think you could definitely, I think terrorists would fit the mold quite well, because we shouldn't try to euphemize the role that Western nations and Western multinational corporations are playing. We should never try to euphemize it. Euphemizing, I think, is a disrespect to those folks who have lost their lives, based on the things, the nefarious things that these imperialist forces have done, trying to balkanize places like Congo and Somalia, and other parts of the continent. It's a serious situation. So tomorrow it's at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time live. If you cannot catch the program, the live 90-minute interview with Brother Kambali of Friends of the Congo, you can always catch it on archive. Like I said, make sure that you send this information out to everybody, all of your networks, pass it on so that they can listen, so that they can pass it on to their networks, and we can keep the ball rolling. And like I said, support those progressive independent media outlets, whether it may be print, radio. I don't know how many are on television, at least especially in the U.S., but especially, you know, even if it's like a YouTube channel where folks are getting progressive information out there about critical issues, you know, that are occurring within the empire of the U.S. Or outside, you know, get that information out there. Support those outlets, support those individuals, and get that information out there. It's about the information. It's about the people that are being effective. And it's affecting all of us in some shape, form, or fashion. We gotta band together to fight. A story that I think needs a little bit of airtime before I get off, about 8 minutes left before we sign off for the evening. I know it's been a very long, long day for me. You know, I didn't get home from work until about 10:30 this evening, started about 8:30. So I just barely got online in time. And but I really think that this story, the story of the great activist, the late great activist Ken Saro-Wiwa of Nigeria, who was hung, and you can say assassinated by Shell and their proxies, and it didn't get the attention it needed from the mainstream media. We know why. I'm barking up a tree that, you know, we obviously know exists. But thank goodness for independent media outlets such as Black Agenda Report. And this is a little two-minute or so commentary that Glenn Ford did on Shell Nigeria. So listen in, and I'll see you on the other end, and we'll close out the evening after the end of this commentary.
The Royal Dutch Shell Oil Corporation is on trial in New York, charged in a civil suit with complicity in the death of Nigerian writer and environmental activist Ken Saro-Wiwa and eight comrades in 1995. Saro-Wiwa's execution drew world attention to the environmental catastrophe that oil production has brought to the Delta region of the Niger River, home to the Ogoni people. Saro-Wiwa and his co-defendants were tried by a military government, but Shell Oil is charged with collaboration in the hangings and in the torture of many other Ogonis, all to facilitate multi-billion-dollar profits. Multinational corporations everywhere are following the case, fearing they too may be called to account for their symbiotic relationships with murderous regimes in the resource-rich regions of the world. Nigeria's environmental degradation is a byproduct of the moral and political rot that flows from neocolonialism. It is the physical manifestation of the total surrender of national sovereignty to foreigners, like Shell Oil, by those native classes that rule the lands for the benefit of foreigners. To put one's country's resources at the disposal of foreigners is the ultimate corruption, which leads to every other conceivable crime. It is a false dichotomy to separate the corruption of Nigeria's governments, military or civilian, from the predatory presence of big oil. The two are locked in the deepest embrace. The foreign corporations pay the regime to maintain peace, and the regime reciprocates by imposing on the people a peace of the dead. There are other sources of corruption in the developing world, other contradictions between people and their governments, but the dominance of economic resources by foreigners exacerbates every other division in society. The competition to get into the foreigners' money flow becomes the great game of national political life. The bigger the money flow, the greater the imperative to keep the people in check. The police and army serve as paid thugs for the foreigners' protection. The national debasement is total. Nigeria's most important city, Lagos, is also one of the most expensive in the world, yet 70% of Nigerians subsist on a dollar or less a day. There is no greater corruption imaginable. In court, Shell Oil will seek to present itself as an innocent party, even a victim of African brutality and corruption. Shell is more properly compared to a businessman who hires a hitman to kill a union organizer. The businessman and the hitman are both guilty of capital murder. The greater onus is on the businessman, whose money made the crime possible. In the Niger Delta, Ogoni rebels have cut Nigeria's oil production in half, putting the squeeze on U.S.-based Chevron Oil, where, incidentally, Condoleezza Rice used to work. According to Amnesty International, hundreds of civilians have been killed in the fighting. The Nigerian government has declared the entire Delta a military zone. No doubt, great crimes are being committed at the behest of Big Oil. Before he was put to death, Ken Sarowiwa predicted that it would come to this. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
And that was, once again, that was Glenn Ford with blackagendareport.com. Please check out that website every Wednesday, or throughout the week, but they update it every Wednesday. Hard-hitting critical analysis and commentary that you won't get pretty much anywhere else. As most of you guys already know, probably that case with Shell has ended. Shell settled out of court, unfortunately. I say unfortunately because I think that the had it gone to trial, I think that that it would have really put the pressure on Shell big time, especially if they lost. You know, it really, you know, had the opportunity to truly expose them, because as classic Shell, as classic, you know, big corporation style, they settled out of court and then basically said that, you know, they were doing, you know, the reason why they settled out of court and gave, I believe it was something like $15 million to the families who family members of the victims who, you know, who perished because of Shell. They basically said that they were doing their humanitarian duty, and they weren't accepting any mea culpa for the loss of lives, you know, and environmental terrorism and racism that they were inflicting upon the Ogoni people and folks like Ken Sarowiwa. So the war, the battle rages on, you know. And as I've told many folks, that in any war, you know, it's not just fought on the ground or in, you know, or the sea or the air. It's fought on many fronts. And so this war against breaking up this system that is fueled by capitalism and white supremacy, imperialism and xenophobia, and all those different kinds of things. You know, in order to fight this, we have to fight it through media, through information, because, you know, quite frankly, you're not going to get, not going to continue to pick up folks if they don't know the issue. And if they don't know the issue in all its complexity, it's going to be much more difficult to continue to trudge on. You know, but we must continue to trudge on. We must continue to battle and fight and pick up, you know, comrades and folks who are affected by this. You know, the people in these communities are suffering. And many of them have no idea the root causes of this suffering. And, you know, it's vastly important for us to do so. That's why, you know, I let off, even, it's just amazing. We're in the age of Obama, the religion of Obama. Unfortunately, people are just sucked into this complicity, because now it's a brown skin face on the same old freaking system, the same old system that is, you know, is responsible for waging war in places like Afghanistan and Pakistan and Iraq. You know, this guy, Obama and his administration are spending more money ever than it's been spent before militarily, or I should say more money than the preceding nitwit in office, the mentally challenged and morally challenged George Bush. You know, the Obama administration and himself have signed on to spend more money this upcoming fiscal year than the nitwit George Bush ever did. And that's very telling, you know, because there's so many people that if this was John McCain doing these things, they very, very much would be would be behind the you know, behind the eight ball, trying to pressure him to stop. But since it's a brown skin, phenotypically black president, we see the same thing going on, and the complicity is just incredible. We got to break it down. We got to continue to get the information out there. So for Your World News, it's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure to have you on, you know, tonight. It's been a unique show in terms of airing the documentary, and we will be back tomorrow at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. And it was a very, 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 very special conversation and dialogue that's gonna go, you know, deep into under the surface of what's really going on in Congo with Brother Kambale from Friends of the Congo. So, as usual, Uno the Prophet, a independent rapper from Boston, Massachusetts, is going to take us out with 1 Million Africans. And this is the kind of rap that you will not hear on the mainstream airwaves in any shape, form, or fashion as long as this system exists. System needs to be deconstructed, to be reconstructed. Uno the Prophet. I'll see you all tomorrow.
This song probably been done about a million times, but it ain't never been done like mine. We're talking about a million Africans. We're talking about 10 million Africans. We're talking about 100 million Africans. We're talking about the genocide that went down in Rwanda. We're talking about Darfur. We're talking about Sierra Leone. We're talking about a million diamonds. We're talking about the Congo, B. We're talking about a million of our people in prison. We're talking about a million of our people dead, unemployed, homeless, hungry, B. 1 million Africans. 10 million Africans, 100 million
y'all
Africans.
Tripping. 1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans.
They say we ain't got no right to complain. I just laugh at them. You can have the whips and the chains. I don't hate on them, but hopefully they gonna catch up. I ain't gonna wait on them. Kanye, Lupe, Pharrell, I will skate on them. 1 million black men locked up in prison.
Hold it down.
Think I'm kidding what it is, but I isn't. And if you didn't know, it's just cause you ignorant. Cause pigs lock up motherfuckers just cause of their pigment. That is racial profiling. No, I'm not wildin'. Y'all shuckin' diving.
Yeah, it's about
grinning and smiling. 1 million people was here before they even came. And ever since they came, they just changed the game. They brought a few million more and then they changed our names. That Turner Devil Burner come to burn your shit to flame.
We gon' burn it down, baby.
1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans. 1 million Taino, 1 million Arawak, 10 million more of our people who ain't coming back. 10 million of our people with scars on their back. Cracker, tell me that it don't matter, but matter of fact, I'm the surprise in the box, I will crack a jack. After that ain't nothing else to do but to holler black. 1 million kids who ain't got no options. Either they down with the goons or the goblins. 1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans. Drop them off here and now you is a Haitian. Drop you off here and now you is Jamaican. 1 million, 10 million, let's bring it back, man. Yes, they are the devil. What's the devil to a
black man?
Nathan, nothing. They ain't saying nothing. We don't need another old white man. Finger on the button, cause the last white man had that type of power. Had 6 million people taking gasoline showers. The Bible told me this world is ours. The meek shall inherit, but that don't mean to be cowards. One stupid white man can knock down 2 towers. Y'all niggas got it backwards. Y'all niggas got it backwards. 1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans. 1 million Wampanoag, 1 million Blackfeet, 1 million Navajo, 1
1 million Apache, 1 million Iroquois, 1 million Sioux. You done killed about a billion people, maybe even two. We're taking a nation of millions, hold us back, I thought you knew. And everywhere they go, this is just how they do. Was 11 million Africans living around Soweto. 1 million white folks had them in the ghetto. The ghetto, the ghetto. You all love the ghetto. You talk about it so much, but we ain't seen no bread though. Breaking more. I take 1 million, 2 million, 3 million, 4. Build a couple hundred schools, hit you for 4 million more. 1 million Haitians, refugees, know the score. Cause you don't want 1 million motherfuckers at your door, man. I am Farrakhan and 1 million man marching. Approach me with caution, 1 million people watching. I do this so often, 1 million places on this earth, but I come from Boston. 1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 1 million Africans, 100 million Africans, 1 million Africans, 3 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans. Harriet Tubman came too. We got a long legacy, this is how we do it. Uno the prophet, Nat Turner, devil burner. 1 million Africans. 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans passed through that transatlantic slave trade, the African Holocaust. Don't forget.